Welcome to Bookwaves on Cover to Cover. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Francine Prose, whose latest book is Reading Like a Writer, a guide for people who love books and for those who want to write them. Recent novels include A Changed Man and Blue Angel. There are two short story collections, a collection of novellas. Francine Prose is a contributing editor at Harper. She writes for The New Yorker, The Atlantic Monthly, several other places. Reading Like a Writer is about fiction writing. And my first question, of course, is why are you writing it? There are a lot of books about writing and a lot of classes taught in writing. And some people say you can learn, you cannot learn. Why does this book exist?
Partly because there are so many classes in writing. I mean, I've actually taught them. And one thing that I think everybody who teaches writing has noticed that their students all want to write, but not that many of them want to read. And also there's this kind of idea out there that the way to learn to write is by just taking writing workshops. I mean, I have to say, I don't have an MFA, I don't have a graduate degree, and the way I think I learned to write was by reading. I was a big reader as a kid and read. And even now, my continuing education as a writer, when I need to figure out something, I try and figure out which writer can actually do that thing. So it's written for readers, I mean, who really want to figure out how writers do read, but also for people who do want to write. And, you know, it's a suggestion, the seemingly obvious but apparently radical suggestion that you can learn to write by reading.
Everyone I interview, all the writers, read. I mean, they all began as readers, and many of them only read nonfiction now because they don't want to be, quote, influenced by other writers, which you understand as well, I would think.
Well, no, actually, I don't. I always hear that. I always hear people saying, I can't possibly read when I'm writing because I'm so afraid. And they usually say, you know, I'm so terrified that I might be influenced by Chekhov or Tolstoy or Dostoevsky when I'm writing. And I think, you wish. That's the best case scenario. If only that would happen.
I'm not sure if it's reading Tolstoy, Chekhov, or Dostoevsky, but if you're a mystery writer, maybe you shouldn't read Robert B. Parker.
That might be true, too. That might be true.
Francine Prose, there are several areas that you discuss in your book, and I'm going to try and experiment here. I just finished your most recent novel, A Changed Man. What I'd like to do is kind of discuss some of these topics in the context of your own book, not just to see whether you can keep up, because I'll say this now, maybe I'll just jump the gun, because in the last chapter, when you talk about Chekhov, you make the comment that all of my writing tips, all of my laws about writing should be thrown out the window because you can do that and be Chekhov. It's like Emily Latella from Saturday Night Live writing a whole book and then going, well, never mind.
Never mind.
But I think in a context, they are important. So let's start with Francine Prose's, your book, A Changed Man. You start by talking about words and choosing the right words. In writing a book like A Changed Man, how important was that? And how important was that in the first draft?
It was important all the way through. And in fact, it was the only way I was able to write it. I mean, that is one of my main characters. There are four point of view characters, a neo-Nazi, a kind of the so-called change man of the title, a reforming or recovering neo-Nazi, Vincent Noland, and a 16-year-old boy, and the elderly head of a human rights foundation and a Holocaust survivor, and a woman who's the development director for the foundation. And in each case, the only way I was able to write those characters was to come up with the language they used. Language was everything for me when I was writing the book. So when I knew, they're all written in sort of close, I guess what they call close third-person point of view, which is really a kind of disguised first-person point of view. When I knew the words, the literal words that were running through their heads, that was when I was able to get the characters and feel confident enough, because none of those characters are me, I hope, needless to say. So I needed to find their language to be able to imagine my way into their ways of thinking.
That requires research, because if you're going to get it right, you have to know the words, right? So how did you deal with the neo-Nazi and the 16-year-old?
Well, the 16-year-old required, and I have two grown sons, so I spent a lot of my time around teenage boys, and that was simple. I mean, I just channeled back to when they were kids. And in fact, one of my sons was kind of amazed by how much disguised information about our family life went into the book. I mean, and what I was saying was everything I knew about neurotic motherhood went into that character, which was tons. The neo-Nazi was a little harder, but what I did was I went online. It's the most frightening thing you can do. I went online and I just Googled the word Aryan, and I got tens of thousands of websites, tens of thousands of the most disturbing, the most upsetting, the most horrifying. And again, I wanted language. What I wanted was the language they used, the words they used. I mean, the fact that they spelled judicial, J-E-W-D-I-C, et cetera. And once I got that, I felt I could write the character. But, you know, I had this amazing experience, or again, disturbing experience. Recently, I went to talk to a high school, and it was the DeWitt Clinton High School in New York City, which is, you know, a tough school. And I was talking to the honors class, and they were geniuses. I mean, these kids were geniuses. They were extraordinary. And they had read A Changed Man. And they got every joke. They got every bit of subject. They were amazing kids. So they asked me the same question. And I said, well, look, you can try it yourself. Just Google Arian. And the teacher said, actually, they can't do that from the school because the guards on the computers in the school are so broad. He said, you know, they can't possibly do that because the Arian is one of the words. And he said, actually, he tried it with the kids. He thought, yeah. You know, because I had told him, he tried it with the kids and they couldn't do it.
And that's so weird because the last part of the book concerns the subject matter of a paper that Hitler might have been gay.
Right.
And we're coming right back to the same
exactly.
thing.
Exactly. I know. Life imitates art, imitates life, imitates art.
When I tried writing an unpublished novel, a friend of mine sat me down and we were going through line by line. And on the second draft, she said, red, you're using the word red. Why not pick a better word, a more punchy word? I eventually chose the word crimson. How important is punchy words in terms of writing like that and rewriting?
You know, I saw on TV, it was one of these English classes that was on PBS that was supposed to go into the schools, and they would have these pictures on the screen, and then they would have some words that they thought a kid might write, and then they would have the words that the kids should have written because they were punchier, I guess that's what. So it would be, you know, the clouds sped across the horizon, and then it would say, no, that's wrong, the clouds scudded across, and I thought, who uses scudded? You know, who except somebody? And every so often I'll read something, and I can see this person eighth grade teacher telling him or her not to use. I mean, my feeling is, why use the fancy, complicated word when the simple word is actually the right word that you need?
I also keep thinking back to a book like Dubliners, which is so simple in its writing. Every word is simple. Nabokov overwrites, but a lot of them, it's just simple language.
Well, yeah, that's just such a range. You know, in Reading Like a Writer, there's a chapter on words and another on sentences. And when I went through, I was just trying to find the widest range possible. So on the one hand, you know, I took Alice Munro, who writes the simplest, as a friend of mine says, untarted up prose that you can imagine. You know, I mean, it's like a shaker box. It's so simple. And then there's a sentence in there by Virginia Woolf that's 181 words long and is this marvel of clarity and precision. So, you know, art is pretty wide.
The next chapter is on sentences, Francine Prose, and you make a point of saying that, beyond anything, good grammar really is important.
Yeah. Well, I quote a friend as saying something like, you know, when you're writing, it's as if you're inviting someone over to your house, and grammar is a way of making the reader feel that you're not going to harm them, you know, especially if you're serving something that might not be expected. I mean, it's the rules of English language, because clarity is important. Clarity is important. And I think grammar, you know, that is, if you can tell, you know, just to be schoolmarmish here for a moment, if you can tell what adjective modifies which noun and what phrase follows, which it really helps you figure out on the most basic level what the writer's saying.
Then there's the example of hopefully, which is often misplaced. Does that even matter?
Everyone understands what you mean when you use it incorrectly. On the other hand, every so often I'll hear it used incorrectly, and I can't help myself. I'll think, oops, that's not exactly how you use it, especially when I'm using it incorrectly.
Is it something in A Changed Man, is the grammar so automatic to you that you, throughout the book, you never once had to think about it, or were you thinking about it every sentence?
Well, again, it varied from character to character. I mean, you know, half of the way, three-quarters of the way through the book, my rather sweet neo-Nazi is less sweet cousin, the real deal, shows up, and his grammar is not that great. I mean, he really is a kind of nasty guy. So that required a kind of readjustment to get that right. I mean, none of them are speaking like the King James Bible, exactly.
Right. The character of Meyer, this is the old man, I did not get the sense he had an accent, but he would have had an accent. And how do you try to bring that in there?
You know, it's funny you say that. I never thought of him as having had an accent. And you're right, he probably would have had an accent. I just assumed that it was, he's so elegant, and by now it would have been just one of those perfectly elegant, faded, you know, an Elie Wiesel accent, for example, mild,
right.
Mild, so.
You also talk about the nature of paragraphs, which I find interesting because a lot of thriller writers try to make their paragraphs one sentence. You kind of talk that down.
Well, it is kind of, a friend of mine says one sentence paragraphs are like a poke in the ribs, and you may not always want to get your ribs poked. But, you know, speaking of thriller writers, I did find this marvelous paragraph from a Rick Stout mystery about paragraphing because, you know, as I say in the book, I kind of wrote the book like Tom Sawyer at Painting the Fence, and I was calling and emailing my other writer friends and saying, okay, who writes great sentences, who writes great paragraphs, et cetera, et cetera. And David Gates said to me, you should look in this Rex Stout mystery because Nero Wolfe is solving a case, a plagiarism case, and he solves it by paying attention to the paragraphs because he says, he tells Archie, no two writers paragraph the same way. And in fact, it works. That is how he solves the case.
In A Changed Man, again, is this something that's instinctive for you at this point?
Yeah. I mean, it always was because I never quite understood what they said in school about, you know, the topical sentence. I never exactly got what that meant.
I may be jumping the gun here, but I've interviewed Ethan Kanen a couple of times, and he talks a lot about voice and what is voice. Where do you think voice fits into this? Whatever it is.
Well, I guess voice is, you know, it answers the question of who's telling the story and what the vocabulary of the storyteller. But when I was writing the book, I began to notice these things that I just hadn't paid attention to before. I mean, for example, people talk about omniscient narrators as if there were this kind of godlike third-person narrator. But in fact, if you actually look at things like word choice or diction or phrasing, often the so-called omniscient narrator has a personality and has an attitude and has various opinions on things that just come out in kind of subtle or not so subtle ways.
Not too long ago, I interviewed Jennifer Egan, whose latest book is The Keep, and she plays with that in having the omniscient narrator be another character, and then there's almost an omniscient narrator beyond the omniscient narrator.
Oh, isn't that a marvelous book? I just adored that book. And I mean, I was reading it. You know, and again, talk about reading like a writer. I was reading that and saying, gosh, I can't believe she's doing this. I can't believe she's getting away with this. I can't believe she's actually managing to make this work. And, you know, just the levels of stories within stories and how the story keeps changing and the plot. I thought it was a marvelous book.
The question is, how do you know if it's successful or if it's failed? I mean, you said she pulls it off. Well, what is it? If she doesn't pull it off, you go, oh, this is hokey. How do you make that determination?
Well, you might go, gee, I wonder what's in the refrigerator, or I wonder what's on TV if I'm missing something. For me, it has something to do with my attention, that it just keeps a hold on my attention. And, you know, the question of putting something down or not putting something down is still very central to me. You know, finally, if some writer doesn't pull it off, you're reading and you think, you know, I just don't believe a word of this. I just don't. It's just not working for me. It just doesn't hold together, even if it's fantasy. I mean, in a sense, you have to believe it. And once you stop believing it, it just kind of throws you out of the novel and you're looking for something else.
A friend of mine, another writer, thriller writer, once said the most important thing is to remember that when you're writing, it's in a way a movie inside your head. So make sure, as a writer, that the reader sees what's going on in their head. Do you think that's true?
Well, you know, that's why Blue Angel and A Changed Man are both written in the present tense. And I always used to kind of put down present tense writing. I thought it was kind of gimmicky and so forth. It's like second-person writing. But writing in the present tense made it possible for me to see that movie, as you say, as if it were happening in real time. I mean, I was just watching this thing take place and then writing it down. I mean, I know it sounds a little wacky, but that's what was going on. So absolutely. I mean, you really are watching this thing and, in a way, channeling. I mean, taking dictation from characters. They'd start talking.
It seems like in a book like A Changed Man, which is all about character, the characters would do that. And to some degree, do you just sit back and wait and see what they're going to do next?
After a while. And that's when you know it is working. They do take on a life, and they do, in fact, say things that you weren't expecting them to say. And that's the most fun thing about writing. You know, you go to your desk, and you had one thing in mind, and something else happens, and it's so thrilling, you just say, that's it, I'm done for the day. You know, I feel like I better be careful who I say these things. It's not, you're not literally hearing a voice, but it's as if you are watching and listening and something's happening and, you know, you close your eyes and there it is. It's all transpiring.
Now, dialogue. Okay, what I found in my unpublished book, never-to-be-published book, people kept saying, you got the dialogue right. And I realized that all I did was I sat there after writing a sentence and just said it aloud a few times to see if it worked.
Right. Would anyone actually talk this way? That is a real question. And I think when people talk about an ear for dialogue, that's really what they're talking about. You know, whether it sounds possible. And if you can't pronounce it, if you can't get that sentence of dialogue out of your mouth, chances are it's not going to be the most, you know, the most felicitous line of dialogue. On the other hand, or maybe not the other hand, I mean, additionally, if you read Emily Bronte or George Eliot, you know, books written in an entirely different century, when you would think people spoke completely differently, you can understand the dialogue perfectly well, and it still sounds like naturalistic dialogue. So go figure.
It also gets pretty weird if you're reading translation.
It does. And it can get really weird if you're reading bad translation, which happens very often. Nabokov, he says, don't even bother reading Gogol if you can't read Russian. Which is so depressing, you know, sorry, I'll never read Gogol. But I had the experience of trying to teach, I think, The Overcoat to a class of students, undergraduates, and they were working from an anthology. And none of my kids noticed that the story was funny at all. They just didn't even notice that there was anything even ironic. And I thought, how could that be? And then I looked at the translation that they were using, and the translation made it impossible to figure out there was a single funny thing happening in the story. I mean, I did an article for Harper's some while ago, but the new translation of the Isaac Babel, the complete works of Isaac Babel, and I criticized the new translation, and there was this big fuss, and Babel's daughter wrote into Harper's saying, you know, Francine Prose doesn't even speak Russian, what does she know, da, da, da. And then, you know, and translators are a kind of passionate bunch. So I started getting all these letters and emails from translators saying, no, 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 you're right. And one translator wrote me an email in which he said, for example, in the translation, in the new translation, there's a line that goes, is translated as follows, on the day he was beheaded, the captain, blah, blah, blah. The translator said to me, actually, what it means is on the day of the beheading, meaning John the Baptist's birthday, name day. So in other words, the captain never lost his head during the story. It was just happened on June 24th or whenever that was. So, and, you know, you would think that would be a fairly serious mistake to have in a translation of a story.
I remember reading 100 Years of Solitude, and I noticed the translator was a guy named Gregory Rabassa. And I noticed a difference in Garcia Marquez when other people began
translating him. That's right. Rabassa was a marvelous translator.
Before we move off translation, there are writers I know who I've interviewed who can speak English, but they write in whatever their native mm-hmm. tongue is. And then it's translated and they work on it. Mm-hmm. And that seems to work if the writer is there sitting there, but frequently they're not because the writer's dead. There's nothing you can do about that.
Well, I mean, Tatiana Tolstoy is a good example. She writes in Russian but speaks perfect English in her translation. And Jamie Gambrell, who translates Tolstoy, is a great translator. So her translations are marvelously colloquial and readable, and they seem as if they were written in English.
Should we be afraid of translations then a little bit?
I think they're the only choice we have. There's a figure that I saw that under 200 books a year are being translated in the United States now. So with the increasing insularity and jingoism and xenophobia that we have to have nothing, no literature coming in from anywhere else is terrifying.
You're listening to an interview with Francine Prose, whose latest book is Reading Like a Writer. Two other areas in your book, Changed Man, Francine Prose, are details and gesture. And it seems as if it's something that people ignore, particularly details, things that make it feel real, I guess mm-hmm. that would be. That's what you're talking about.
Yeah, and also, you know, just little facts of observation, little things that do give a real atmosphere. I mean, there's such things a friend of mine calls abject detail. I mean, you know, the sort of sentence that goes, the bookshelf, it was one of those gray metal bookshelves with the little holes in the metal bars. You know, you don't really, I mean, you know what that is without that.
Right.
But on the other hand, little details that you can see. I mean, there's a detail in Chekhov's story, The Murder, that I mentioned. Someone's eating a boiled potato at the beginning of the story. And then there's this grisly murder as the story progresses. And by the end of the story, there's this boiled potato sitting in a pool of blood on the kitchen floor. What a great detail.
One thing I've noticed in a lot of, quote, literary books, lists of what's in a desk, lists of what's in a refrigerator. What's that about? Is that creating detail? Sometimes I feel as it's just pretentious junk.
It depends. Again, it depends how it's used. I mean, one of my favorite stories to teach is Paul Bowles' A Distant Episode. And, you know, there's a character, the professor, who's traveling around Morocco. And early in the story, I think in the first paragraph, we learn that the professor has in his luggage maps, sun lotions, and medicines. It's a list, but we get the professor's entire character in those three things that are in the list. So, you know, he's a cautious guy, he's nervous, he's not happy traveling, you know, et cetera, et cetera. So lists, like everything else, can be used really well. It just depends who's doing it and how they do it.
An unreliable narrator throws everything for a loop, doesn't he?
Yeah, and there's some stories that really need an unreliable narrator. I mean, John Cheever's Goodbye, My Brother is a perfect example of that. I mean, you know, the most dysfunctional New England family narrated by a guy who thinks that they're just this little kind of paradise of family love. The story wouldn't work if the guy actually knew what was going on really in his family.
One thing that we began talking about before we get on the air, and I would like to bring it up, is the subject of endings, because you don't go into it in reading like a writer. That same friend of mine who gave me the advice about seeing the movie, he thinks an ending is incredibly important in the sense that it must finish the story but also give the reader a certain satisfaction. So ending it at the moment when the good guys win, mm-hmm, doesn't give the reader any satisfaction. You need a little bit more.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, you're right. I don't go into it in reading like a writer. I mean, I'm going to have to save that for more reading like a writer or rereading like a writer. I always thought that the greatest ending in literature was the ending of Chekhov's The Lady with the Pet Dog, which is the hardest part was still before them. I mean, that seemed to me the most lifelike, because that's like life, you know. And I wrote a lot of unresolved endings as a result. And then I wrote one young adult novel called After, and it's the most political novel I've done. It's about the high school as police state. And, you know, there's a nearby school shooting, and little by little the kids find their rights taken away. And I gave the book an unresolved ending. I mean, I knew the characters were safe, the main characters, but we didn't know exactly what was going to happen to them. And I started getting these letters from kids all over the country saying, I really like the book until I got the ending, and I really hate the ending. Like, what happens to these people, and is there going to be a sequel, and da-da-da-da-da. And I was a little surprised. I mean, no one had ever told me that you were – I mean, when I was their age, I didn't know that you could write to writers complaining about the ending of their book. But on the other hand, I thought, it turns out the kids hate unresolved endings, just despise them, and maybe there's something – you know, maybe the adult reader has some of that in the adult reader. So my endings have been getting more and more resolved. I mean, A Changed Man is much more resolved, the ending, than Blue Angel, for example. And the book I'm working on now has quite a resolved ending.
But for me, A Changed Man ended a chapter too soon.
Many people said the Blue Angel ended about six chapters too soon. So we're working there. The ending of A Changed Man, I didn't actually believe that the reformed neo-Nazi and the suburban housewife would ride off into the sunset for happily ever after. But I thought that to explore the reasons why they might not would take another novel equally as long as the first novel, so I couldn't really do that. When they made a film of Household Saints, one of my earlier novels, I remember going to a press conference, and the actors who were in the film were all being interviewed, and Michael Imperioli, who's since gotten very well known as Chris on The Sopranos, was in the film. And one of the reporters asked him what happened to the character he plays in the film made for my novel after the film is over. And I was astonished. He had it all worked out. He had the rest of the guy's life in his head. And I thought, gee, I wish I'd known that when I was writing the novel. Maybe it would have been different.
I want to walk away with a little satisfaction, right, in the story. And that's why I don't like a lot of short stories. Because short stories often just stop. They don't end.
Well, short stories are like poems in a way. I mean, they leave you with a kind of feeling, and it's often mysterious, and it's often unresolved, and it's often, I mean, for example, I've been reading a lot of, or not a lot, as much as I can find in English, of Roberto Bolaño, who writes these marvelous short stories, and all of them have a kind of mysterious ending that just, they do stop. But that's okay with me.
And that brings up the question of the relation of a book like Reading Like a Writer to taste.
Oh, sure. And, you know, as I say in the book, I never got Trollope. I still haven't got Trollope. You know, it doesn't take me to say there's zillions of passionate Trollope fans out there reading and rereading Trollope. You know, maybe in 10 years I'll decide he was a great writer. So, of course, there's taste.
Is there a difference between good and bad literature?
Well, language is key, I think. If there are wonderful sentences, chances are it's good literature. On the other hand, there are things that you read just to get you through the airplane flight that aren't necessarily great literature but have a huge value, that are very important. I mean, they take your mind off the fact that you're 30,000 feet up in the air in a sardine can, and I'm very grateful for books like that as well.
There's exactly one author that you criticize as not a good writer in the book. Only one, and it's Elmore Leonard.
No, really? Oh, I know. I say that you can remember things that happened in Elmore Leonard books, but not the character to whom they happened to, or something.
Oh, well, something to the effect of you can't remember anything.
You know, it's sort of true, although I love reading Elmore Leonard, in fact, and I think he's kind of a wonderful writer. But if someone said to me, okay, you know, what happens in this novel and what happens, and, you know, as I said in the book, usually I find myself saying, oh, is that the one in which the character got pushed out the high window? Or although, on the other hand, I do remember, which book is it, Teddy Magic's Mother Feeding the Parrot from Her Mouth? Do you remember that?
I remember it, but I couldn't tell you. Was it La Brava? I couldn't tell you which book it was.
I couldn't either, but it was pretty great.
I love reading Robert B. Parker because it's sort of like the pickled ginger that you have to get the taste of another book out of your mouth. But then afterward, I don't remember what the pickled ginger tastes like at all. I just know that I've read the book, and if I don't write down the name of the book, I won't even know that I've done that.
That's a problem with mysteries often. I mean, I'll read three quarters of the way through a mystery and realize that I've read it before. And I'm thinking, why do I know who did it? And then I realize it's because I've read the novel before.
But that's not the sign of anything other than the fact that that's what the book is. Maybe that's what defines genre.
It may be.
Francine Prose, I'd like to talk a little about some other issues. In 1999, you wrote an article very critical of Maya Angelou. First of all, I'm not that familiar with the article. What was your thesis in that?
Well, it was an article about how literature is taught in high school, basically. So one of the things I did was I went out and found 80 reading lists from high schools across the country, public, private, parochial, all sorts of schools, and I looked and saw what were the common denominators. So, for example, it turns out that you can't graduate, or at that point you couldn't graduate from a high school in this country without having read I Know Why the Caged Bird Sings. And I thought I would go back and read it and look at it. And I kept opening it at random and finding these terrible sentences. So one of the things I said...
Like what?
Like mixed metaphors and wild overwriting and things that just didn't quite make sense. And I also felt that it was the sort of thing that teachers might teach because you can draw sort of easy, obvious moral lessons. One of the things I said in the article was that, you know, I'm, needless to say, totally in favor of a hugely inclusive multicultural curriculum. So it wasn't as if I was saying only teach works by dead white males, but I was saying, you know, from every community, there are geniuses. There are writers who are geniuses. I mean, African-American writers, it needs hardly be said. Toni Morrison, James Baldwin, the young Zizi Packer. I mean, there's so many writers. Colson Whitehead. I mean, there are, you know, many, many writers. And I didn't think Maya Angelou was one of the great writers. What I wish I'd said, and, you know, often after you write the article, you realize what you should have said, is that if one kid read Maya Angelou and became a reader as a consequence, then bless her heart, and I'm very glad that book those books exist. But I didn't remember to say it, so, and I live to regret it. And it was a nightmare. I mean, after the piece came out, it was like a three-month nightmare that I found myself plunged into the middle of. But on the other hand, I've taught a lot, and I know what kids like and what kids don't like, and it seems to me that kids were not responding to Maya Angelou the way they might respond to other things. If you're trying to teach kids to write clearly, which I think should be a goal, and you use as a model a writer whose sentences could hardly be murkier and less easy to, you know, parse in this, I'm not necessarily sure that that's a good example for kids. You can teach Baldwin and Zizi Packer and Toni Morrison and, you know, dozens, I mean, the list could go on forever, of writers from every community who were from non-white communities who wrote lucidly and beautifully and clearly and so forth and so on.
How do you feel about just getting involved in controversy? I mean, did you know when you were writing it that you'd be opening that door?
No, I always think I'm saying the most obvious thing. I can't believe anyone, you know, I always think it's so obvious. Why do I have to say this? And then I'm kind of stunned when it turns out to be controversial.
What are other examples where you got yourself into trouble?
Well, I wrote a piece in, in Harper's about the fact that, also in Harper's, about the fact that the playing field was not level for male and female writers, and still isn't. I mean, if you look at lists of prizes and reviews in major review publications and so forth, it's not as if I was saying 51% of all prizes should go to women. I don't believe in a quota system, but in fact, women's writing is still taken less seriously. Women in general, I hardly have to say, are taken less seriously. And the piece came out, and again, I thought, gee, everyone knows this. I don't know why I have to say it. And it was like, I'd thrown a bomb into literary culture.
Last year, there was a list of the top 50 books, I think.
And one was by a woman, right?
Do you think writers have any responsibility in a political sense at all?
Not in terms of their fiction or poetry, but certainly, if you can write and if you can find a way of saying what's going on and telling the truth about it, it's extremely important. And there are fewer and fewer occasions on which we're allowed to tell the truth. I mean, the mainstream media forget about it. So I think if writers can function as essayists and can function as polemicists and can get on the radio like here and so forth, that they really should do it. But I don't think your work has to be necessarily political.
There's a writer named Robert Olin Butler who made a comment to me once that you can't convince anybody through logic, mm-hmm. but you can through fiction because it's coming in the back door. And I asked cognitive linguist George Lakoff that mm-hmm. same question. He said, absolutely. I've asked other people and they've said, not a chance. What do you think?
Oh, I think absolutely. But, I think, for example, that's the real reason why Huckleberry Finn is still such a controversial book, because you can read all the histories of slavery that you can, and you can read all the facts and essays about the fact that we were a slaveholding society. But when you read Huckleberry Finn, it's as if you are getting at the problem from the inside. It's what it was like to live in a pathological slaveholding society, which was our society. And I think because we have so much difficulty in acknowledging that that's how we lived and that's who we were, that book is going to disturb people as long as it exists.
I keep thinking about the right-wing fundamentalists being opposed to Harry Potter. In a weird way, they have a point then, because it is subversive. For them?
All literature is subversive. All literature is. And a friend of mine said, literature is a weapon against propaganda. I mean, whatever you're told about how different kinds of people are and what a certain group is like, you read literature and you find out that they're actually human beings, very much like yourself.
How do you get someone to start reading?
I think you give them a book in which they can lose themselves, a book in which they want to find out what happens next, a book in which they can relate to a character and be drawn into that character's situation, and then the rest will take care of itself.
I remember someone once saying that the real golden age of science fiction is 15.
Yeah, that's when I used to read science fiction.
What do you think it is about science fiction and teenagers?
Well, teenagers are incredibly imaginative, and also teenagers, I think, are discovering how the world is and wishing it weren't that way and wishing there were another world that they could enter into, and science fiction satisfies all those needs.
Francine Prose, we're all sitting here astonished at what's happened to America. As an essayist in places like The New Yorker, where do you think we are going?
I think we're at one of the darkest moments that we've ever been at our history. I mean, I think... Well, it's interesting to me because I live in New York, and you get in a cab in New York, and every cab driver you meet says something like, well, just the other day it happened to me, a cab driver said something like, well, the cab driver was listening to BAI, in fact, and I said, gee, that's the only thing you can listen to anymore. And the cab driver said, well, that's absolutely right. The cab driver was Haitian. The cab driver said, the mainstream media will not tell you, for example, that this bill on detainees is ignoring the most basic constitutional principles. He said, habeas corpus, for example, aren't we guaranteed that in the Constitution and so forth, the Bill of Rights? And mainstream media will not point this out. I think that's absolutely right. I mean, that's why I'm so grateful for KPFA and BAI, just to remind us of what's happening around us.
I'm also concerned here because sometimes there are politicos who want to remove literature from the air, thinking that the arts are apolitical, but the arts are extremely political.
Extremely political. Extremely. Well, they remind us of our humanity, and humanity is finally, I would like to think, the end point of politics.
Francine Prose, you have these two recent novels, Blue Angel, Changed Man. You've written nonfiction here. You have another collection of essays, I think, that came out last year. Is that correct?
No, I have a book on Caravaggio came out last year.
Okay.
The
what do you have in store?
I'm working on a new novel. It's going very slowly, but eventually, someday, I hope it will be finished.
How does writing the essays impact your writing fiction?
Well, I got to put so many quotes from great writers into Reading Like a Writer that it actually helped my fiction while I was writing it.
Really?
I type out a Virginia Woolf sentence, and my sentences got better for a while.
You've been listening to an interview with Francine Prose, whose latest book is Reading Like a Writer. I'm Richard Walensky on Cover to Cover.